Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey people, thanks very much for joining me for episode 53 of A Small Voice podcast. Welcome along. It's busy times in Photoland, here in London at least. Last weekend I attended a two-day event that we have here called Offspring Photo Meet. And there's a Small Voice special on that coming up. Photo London starts today, our annual industry shindig, in the lovely setting of Somerset House. And the city has dutifully laid on its trademark weather for the visitors, so it's pissing with rain. But nevertheless, I will be ligging about down there all week on your behalf, and as with last year, there will also be a special on that event coming up in the future. Last night, I went to the 70th birthday bash of a famous agency, Camera Press, which is why I feel awful right now. I only had two glasses of champagne, which is now apparently all it takes to give me a dreadful hangover. A champagne-induced hangover, if that isn't the very definition of a first-world problem, I don't know what is. Before I introduce my guest this week, a little bit of business as usual. Please do go to iTunes and drop off a review of the podcast if you've got about 30 seconds to spare. If you are so inclined, please go to the website and sign up for a very small recurring donation, which will help to pay for my coffee, which I'm going to need this morning. If you need a Squarespace website, which you probably do if your website's a bit crap, let me know and I will make one for you. This week on the podcast, I chat to Spencer Murphy, who's just published his first photo book, Urban Dirt Bikers, with Hoxton Mini Press. Their website describes Spencer as a fine art and commercial photographer. I would add documentary photographer to that, but he's probably best known for his portrait photography. In 2013, he won the National Portrait Gallery's Taylor Wessing Portrait Prize, his work having been selected for the exhibition six times previously. Spencer's personal work is often concerned with the notion of the outsider, those who live an alternative rebel lifestyle away from or in spite of our preconceptions of what is deemed to be normal. Spencer was born in 1978 and grew up in the Kentish countryside. Raised in relative isolation, miles from the nearest shop or school, Spencer often found himself with only his imagination for company and the surrounding woodland as his playground. It was a combination of this imagination and an early discovery of his mother's back issues of Life and National Geographic magazine that sparked an early enthusiasm for photography at the age of 11. As a result, his parents bought him his first camera, and photography quickly became a channel for his creativity. Spencer now divides his time between creating self-initiated personal projects and taking on photographic commissions. He's contributed to many magazines, including The Guardian Weekend, The Telegraph Magazine, Time, Monocle and Wallpaper. His portraits have also appeared in such publications as Rolling Stone Magazine, GQ and Dazed and Confused, and he has exhibited throughout Europe and North America. His work is now held in the National Portrait Gallery's permanent collection. Top man, here's Spencer Murphy.
So currently, I'm kind of in between things, because the project's just finished, so publishing the book's just finished.
Your book project, yeah, which we're going to talk about, obviously.
Yeah. So, I'm currently kind of just weighing up what's next. I've got a list of ideas, and it's just, that kind of is the way I work, is I'll have a list, like handwritten list on my desk of all these ideas that have been going on for like years, and I'll pick, you know, the one that I'm feeling at the moment, usually because it's the most accessible one.
Mm.
So yeah, I've got to pick the next one really.
Mm. So, what, how's it feel to sort of have a book all done and dusted? That must be quite gratifying.
Yeah, it is. What's really gratifying about it is I probably started the project a year ago to the day of having a book in my hand.
Really? And so that's pretty fast turnaround.
Yeah, it was, because I'd been speaking with Hoxton Mini Press prior to starting the project, and we kind of knew that we wanted to do something together, but I didn't have anything that fit their remit, because they were, before now, they were only kind of East London-based projects, and now they've kind of gone to a broader urban...
Yeah,
and, I mean, so I kind of halfway through doing the project, I knew it could be up their street and went to see them with it.
Oh, great, okay.
So we kind of had it planned in.
You already had a relationship with Martin,
right, yeah.
Osborne, who runs the show. Just for people, I guess I've mentioned it has come up many times on the podcast because I've spoken to quite a few Hoxton Mini Press people who've done books with them, and it's a London-based imprint run by a photographer, Martin Osborne, and his wife, Anne, and they kind of specialised, well, they, as you say, started out specialising in books about East London, and now they've sort of expanded their remit somewhat. But it's Hoxton Mini Press if people want to. I'm just thinking about my imaginary listener in Kansas City. If people want to check it out, hoxtonminipress.com. And it's a great thing. And I haven't had Martin on the podcast because he's so busy that, yeah,
he'd
you know,
be a great one to
yeah.
have.
It's very interesting. You know, I hope to get him one of these days. He's got an open invitation, of course. It'd be lovely to talk to him. But God bless him, you know, the man has about 3 full-time jobs.
He's got a lot going on.
Yeah. So we'll talk about the book. We'll talk about the project. But you mentioned ideas. I was going to ask you about ideas. So you've got a list. I mean, are you quite good at generating ideas?
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be a problem. Generating the time and the money to do the ideas is a problem.
Right.
And actually getting out there and doing them. But yeah, the ideas thing has never really been an issue for me. It's just... yeah, so it's really the time and money restraints. And yeah. I've got a list of projects, some of them that have stayed on the list for a long time, just purely because of geographical location, really.
Mm. So what do you do? Like, you walk around, like, you carry a notebook around with you and have these kind of light bulb moments, or is there some kind of active process?
A bit of both. I'd say notebook, and it's now my phone, I think, as it is
yeah,
with
yeah.
everyone. So there's an ongoing list of things on my phone, and sometimes those get lost because I don't always refer back to it.
Mm.
But yeah, I'm generally in reach of my desk when they come to me, so I'll just kind of scribble them down, and then I'll turn that into, you know, one A4 sheet that will stay on my desk.
But are you actively, you know, is it a process which is, you know, you wait for inspiration to strike? Because, you know, there's a lot of talk about ideas and you know, you can decide to have them, kind of thing.
True, yeah. I think you definitely can, because you can, you could spend a day going around galleries or you know, watching documentaries or photographer interviews or something, you know, purely to kind of gestate and have that experience, and that will definitely foster ideas. But yeah, sometimes they come out of nowhere. You know, seeing something random or thinking, oh, you know, those two things put together make an interesting idea.
Right. Yeah, it's like kind of idea sex, you know, like one idea and another idea, and you kind of mate them together.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Let's talk about the book project, and then we can go back.
Okay.
It's called Urban Dirt Bikers, and it features, well, the clue's in the title, guys and girls who ride off-road bikes, but they ride it sort of wasteland, and it's an urban thing, obviously, hence the name.
Yes, yeah, I mean, they ride it most of the time. Where you know where you'll find packs of them is in kind of wasteland and industrial estates, but it kind of its genesis was in America, and it's on the streets amongst traffic is what makes it very different. And certainly in America, they don't really wear protective gear. They're dressed in urban gear, and so it's quite a fashion that goes along with it. And they weave in and out of traffic and get chased by police and all sorts.
Oh, really? And there was a documentary, wasn't there?
Yes, and that's what kind of drew my attention to it. I think it was 2013 documentary, right, called 12 O'Clock Boys,
right?
Which is amazing documentary, and it kind of centers around this one kid who wants to become one of these urban dirt bikers, and his journey into that scene. And and it's nice. What's nice about the UK version has taken on its own life, which is very kind of English, and so there's kind of like the pedal bike kids that see, sort of look up to all the dirt bikers, and some of these guys are quite, you know, they've got quite a following. Some of them have got like 70,000 followers on Instagram, and they kind of have this rite of passage where they'll start off on the pedal bikes kind of as spectators and pulling tricks on their pedal bikes, and then as soon as they can get a scooter, there's kind of these scooter gangs. And Vice actually did a documentary about the scooter gangs a few years ago as well. And many of those are now kind of the people with 70,000 followers on their Instagram. And then, yeah, eventually once they're off of the L plates on their scooters, they'll kind of graduate up to the motorbike.
Because I presume some of them are just not old enough to ride on the road. Is that one of the reasons they...
I mean, that's right. And when you go to the waste grounds, especially some of the less urban ones, you'll see kind of fathers and sons, you know, with their sons on the front of the bikes, and kids that are clearly not old enough to ride them. But at the industrial estates, there's less of that because they are, for all intents and purposes, public roads, I think.
Right. But when you first saw this documentary, did anything click then, or did it something that just kind of went to the back of your mind? Because you didn't start this project till sometime after that.
No. I mean, I didn't. I was on the lookout for it, and I, you know, it probably did click that, wow, that would be amazing to go over to Baltimore and take photos of that. But there wasn't enough of a pull, because I was kind of sure that someone else, you know, if not the filmmaker, but some other photographer had already jumped on that. And then as soon as I became aware of it happening in the UK, that's when the interest kind of came. And so that was sort of towards the end of 2015. I really knew that there was a culture here. Mm. And then it took me a long while to actually get in with that culture, because it's so secretive.
Okay, so how did you establish that there was something similar here? And then how did you sort of set about getting in?
Well, partly moving here, it sort of coincided with me moving out here, and I live very close to one of the industrial estates, so there's lots of kind of kids around here that go there, but I'd only ever see them riding past me. I didn't know where they were going, and in kind of smaller groups. So and then it was the media was starting to pick up on it, but in a very negative way. So that was kind of what alerted me to the fact that there was a bigger culture here. And then I went online and found that Vice documentary about the scooter gangs.
That was a London thing.
Yes, yeah. And that's really kind of where I was like, oh, okay, so there is a larger group. And I tried through that, I tried finding a few of them and emailing a few of them, and just had no responses whatsoever. But it was a kind of around the same time I sort of started on Instagram at end of 2015, mainly because people were telling me I had to be on Instagram.
Right. So you're a bit of a late adopter to the whole Instagram thing.
I am with generally everything. I'm kind of resistant to technology in general. But yeah. But it proved that was the only way of getting in contact with them. And even with that, it took months. But eventually, just through direct messages on Instagram, eventually one of them said, oh, yeah, come out with us. And that wasn't until almost Easter of last year.
Yeah, because I think you said you were on the verge of giving up. But do you think you would have given up? Or are you quite persistent with these things? Are you quite good at being tenacious? Because it seems to me that that's quite a useful trait to have as a photographer.
Yeah, I think you have to be. But it had got to the point, it was probably about 6 months from the idea and starting to contact them to when one of them actually replied. And I just kind of felt like I'd maybe have carried on every now and again, seeing one and dropping them a message. But and the more people I followed and dropped message, the more people it would, you know, sharp. You might want to be friends with this person, and suddenly my Instagram was full up of pictures of motorbikers. So I think maybe I'd have continued trying, but not quite so hard, because it was getting ridiculous. It was just like blanket no responses from everyone.
Yeah, of course. And like, I guess they're a sort of subculture. You seem to be slightly interested in people on the fringes in some way. Is that something that, you know, kind of is a kind of recurring theme?
Definitely, yeah. I think it runs through all my work. I think I kind of relate it back to the fact that I feel like I'm that person, that I'm kind of the outsider in all of this. And it kind of attracts me to those people. Like I've always been quite socially shy. I grew up in quite an isolated part of, although it's Kent, it's not that isolated, but it was, my situation was quite isolated. I lived kind of a couple of miles from my nearest friend, and I needed a lift to go and see friends. So I spent a lot of time on my own and with my imagination and things. And, you know, it dates back to, I think my final year project at university was about feeling like an outsider in my own family, because I'd moved away to university. My parents had not long separated, and then they'd both kind of then met partners that had their own children, so there were then these two family groups that I didn't feel a part of.
Right.
So my final year project was pretty much about, it was called Relative. I don't really show it anymore, but that was kind of about being an outsider. And then, yeah, there's been lots of the year before I did the dirt bikers, I did a project about woodland squatters who had basically taken over this patch of woodland and were bin diving and growing their own food and that sort of thing. And then the sort of gypsy and traveller horse fairs. And I'd say it even kind of is evident in my landscapes. There's this sense of isolation in my landscape, I think.
Yeah, slight sort of alienation. And do you still feel that way, that you're somehow a bit of an outsider?
Kind of, like, yeah, it's hard to describe. Yeah, I kind of feel like I'm always kind of, and with, you know, even going into the sort of culture of bike life, I then become the outsider, because I'm the kind of guy like knocking on the door asking to take people's photos, and it's kind of, I'm not a socially confident person. I like my own company. So yeah, I kind of see that, and they've always been kind of the interesting groups for me. It's always been those people on the peripheries are kind of, that's like where invention happens and where boundaries get pushed. And so that for me has always been like infinitely interesting. So I kind of see this as a chapter within something bigger that I'm doing, but that hasn't really revealed itself yet.
I mean, it seems almost like you're trying to challenge yourself to some extent. If you're, I mean, I know exactly where you're coming from. You know, being socially awkward is, you know, the kind of trait that might seem like a handicap for a photographer, who is, you know, the whole thing of the job is to, you know, get involved and to I don't know, ingratiate yourself into certain community or whatever. And obviously, that's not something that comes easy to you.
No, but weirdly easier with strangers than with people that I'm meant to be socializing with.
Right, yeah.
Weirdly, because you don't have to go back into that situation. You don't have to make a lasting impression. You kind of, you're there and then you're gone. So
yeah, and you are the outsider, right? So you might as well just kind of, you know, if you're going to be the outsider, yeah, then be the outsider. Yeah. Very kind of full on, yeah.
Yeah, whereas I think where it's more of a handicap is, you know, as a commercial or art photographer, you are kind of expected to be involved in you know, going to private views and doing the whole kind of schmoozing thing, and that's never come natural. In fact, I kind of feel disingenuous because I feel like, oh, they're going to think I'm after something when I just want a conversation. So yeah, it makes me even worse in those situations.
Right. I think. Yeah. Well, I don't think you're alone there. So with the bikers, what was your first kind of result then? When did you get to that point where you're like, okay, this is actually gonna work after all?
So there was one rider, pretty much was the I'm sending this one and then I'm giving up, and he was really receptive and sort of came across really nicely, and said, yeah, well, we do kind of a ride out, me and my kind of group do a ride out, what, sort of once every month, why don't you come on the next one with us? So we went to an abandoned airfield with them, and I sort of got some good results from that trip. I mean, there's a few pictures in the book from that trip. And then within a week or two, he then took me to one of the sort of the more inner city spots, the one that's sort of 15, 20 minutes from here. And that was, I mean, that was kind of, I'm glad I went out with them first, because that was kind of 50 guys at the end of a strip, all kind of, you know, masked up and smoking weed and on big dirt bikes. I think if I'd have driven into that situation without a contact, I probably would have turned around and driven out, because it's a pretty scary environment to go into.
Yeah, that is quite intimidating.
But yeah, he kind of opened that door for me, and then I could say, oh, I know Izzy and I'm doing this project, and it kind of then opened other doors for me, and then people would tell me about other spots. And those ones I did turn up to on my own without a contact, and just kind of said, oh, I'm doing this project, I've been to this other spot. And it kind of just led from there. And then I was kind of confident enough, because I knew that they weren't scary guys. Actually, they were all very nice people. And once you got speaking to them, they were fine. It's just that initial visual.
Yeah, because they cover their faces and it's all that kind of, they've got that very sort of intimidating vibe. I presume some of them cover their faces to get photographed, because, you know, they don't particularly want to encourage interest from the police. But yeah, they've got a certain look. Must have been right then that you realised that you had a really good idea then. That's quite an exciting kind of visual image that you've painted there.
Yeah, I guess that was it. Like, for me, like I was saying, it kind of is a chapter in something bigger that I'm doing, and I didn't expect to spend so much time on it. But the more I went, the more I knew there were other pictures I still hadn't got, And it just kept me going back because I was just like, it's just not finished. And then I'd see another spot on Instagram and I'd be like, because the one round the corner actually is a very ugly location. It's very hard to make it work as backgrounds. It's not even ugly, interesting. It's very modern industrial estate and there's big blue fences everywhere. And so as a background, I ran out of backgrounds very quickly.
Yeah.
So I was kind of all on the constant lookout for other spots to make it work. And I don't think I ever got the picture that was in my head at the beginning of the project, but I got other pictures that I wasn't expecting.
I mean, did you conceive of it as a portrait project, or did you have the idea from the start that it would be kind of mixing portraits with, you know, more kind of documentary type stuff?
I think the latter. I think because that's with my personal work, certainly that's what I always attempt to do, is have kind of almost this filmic thing going on where you combine still life and landscape and portrait to tell kind of a wider narrative, you know, through multiple pictures rather than through a single image.
Mm.
But there's always these standalone images that kind of are conjured up in my head, and generally speaking, you know, I don't achieve those because that's just, you know, invention in my head that's not ever going to happen. But I like kind of how Alex Soph speaks about writing these lists, and he goes out looking for the list, and because he's got that list of things, you're more likely to find them because you're looking for them.
Right, yeah. Well, that's almost like an old school, you know, documentary photography or photojournalism, you know, thing. I remember, you know, being taught about this, that, you know, you make a shot list and then you work through it and you tick those bastards off, you know, as you get them. And and actually it does work, you know. Obviously
it
doesn't mean there isn't space to get the stuff that you're not expecting, but yeah, it does. It's actually quite a useful thing to give it some structure. But I mean, I'm wondering if you were concerned that there was no kind of deeper, you know, significance to the whole thing, that it was a good, interesting story, the sort of thing you'd see in Huck magazine or whatever, but did it would it have enough weight to, you know, become a book?
That really wasn't my concern. But it revealed itself very quickly that there was more depth to it, that, you know, these were kind of like disillusioned youth from London that were being misrepresented in the press, that are actually much more layered individuals than kind of given credit for. So it kind of, yeah, it wasn't something that I was expecting to turn into a book. But then, yeah, there was just so much depth to it that I kind of couldn't stop going back, and then it became evident that it was something bigger that I was working on. And I kind of expected, you know, what drew me to it was the kind of the outlaw look that they had and the dynamism of the tricks that they were doing. But very quickly that kind of dissipated into like a backstory that I needed a few action shots.
Mm.
But that really wasn't what I was there to do, because that's what a photographer within their community would be doing, and I was looking from the outside.
Well, Izzy, that this was the guy that you've already mentioned was your main kind of way into the story,
yeah,
and there's a little, well, there's a quote from him in the book whereby he outlines what I imagine was an accident he had.
Yeah, I'm not, actually not clear on the whether the accident was just on the road on his motorbike or whether it was doing stunts.
Right.
He's never specified that to me, but
Clearly it was I presume it was a road accident of some sort.
Yeah. It's got to be with that sort of list of injuries. It's life changing.
Yeah, I won't read it. It's pretty kind of serious litany of problems that he had. Tell me more about some of the characters that kind of stand out in your mind, and some of the stories, you know, that come along with them.
Well, I suppose, I mean, he'd be sort of the kind of first go-to one, because, I mean, the long and short of it was he was in a coma for 13 days and broke pretty much every bone down half of his body, and then very quick, as soon as he could, got back on a bike and continued to do it, which to me seems crazy. But then when you kind of correlate it with, you know, stuntmen like Evel Knievel, but even, you know, other people we revere like skateboarders and people in squirrel suits, you know, they're kind of revered, and if one of those injured themselves in pursuit of something they love doing, then we kind of hero worship them. Yet we kind of these guys are kind of demonized, and we see that as strange, but actually it's no stranger than any other extreme sport.
Yeah.
So that kind of, for me, that kind of was kind of something to build the story around. And then there were slightly more tragic events. There was when I was out one day, there was a guy called Carlton who died. And that was a real turning point for me, because I was there at that strip that day. The light wasn't very good and there weren't very many people there. So I went off for a coffee, and then we saw helicopters overhead, and we thought it was the police out, so we thought we'd go and see what was going on. And when we got back, he was being resuscitated on the ground. So that, I mean, that was kind of halfway through the project, and I stopped doing it for a while. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to continue.
So that happened there and then, kind of thing, on the day that you were there?
Yeah, and I mean, I was on the spot where the accident happened, was the last place I took a photo about 20 minutes previously.
And what happened?
He had a head-on collision with another bike.
Oh my God.
One of them was a super bike. I'm not sure which he was on.
Because, you know, and the reason I asked specifically is because clearly, you know, the dangers of riding on the road are pretty obvious, but when you've got a bit of space around you, you know, in some ways it's a hell of a lot safer.
Yeah. I mean, and the good thing that came out of that was that the whole of the community got talking, and there was like some of the kind of more respected people like, right, well, how do we make this safer? So from now on, we're only going to do stunts one way down the strip, and then everyone else is that when you're driving back up the strip, you stay on this side. It promoted people wearing protective clothing, so I'm seeing a lot more people in
so
protective clothing.
So they sort of policed it themselves, as it were.
Yeah. So it was kind of, you know, that it wasn't all bad that came out of that, and you know, and they kind of console themselves, and that Carlton died doing what he loved doing, and there was a massive outpouring for him. So it, you know, my reservations about continuing to do it were kind of washed away by that, really, that the sense of community and how they came out for him to raise money for his funeral and that sort of thing. It sort of seemed to be a more of a positive thing, and so I those worries about promoting something that potentially someone could get killed at kind of went away.
Well, you're just you know, shining a light into that particular corner, aren't you, as I guess we're all doing one way or another, and you're not really responsible. I mean, we used to do this stuff when I was a kid. We used to ride around on dirt bikes. So I mean, it wasn't a thing, it wasn't a scene,
and I think that's
we all that's just what, I don't know, I just, my brother was massively into bikes, and so were a bunch of my friends, and so that's what we did. We thought it was harmless fun, but then the police would, you know, turn up and tell us that it wasn't.
And I think that's like Instagram has galvanized it for them. It was, you know, when you ask them when it began, a lot of them will say, well, there's no, it's always been around, there's no real dating, like way of dating it. But the birth of Instagram was when it kind of in this country galvanized, because they all could collectively show each other videos of what they were doing, and then, you know, they'd all meet up, and so then the spots would become more well known.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, because social media is just, you know, invented for, you know, kind of subcultures finding each other, you know, or members of a subculture finding each other and then turning it into a thing. I mean, it's perfect for that, right?
Yeah,
that's exactly what it's good at. So when you got talking to Hoxton Mini Press, were they immediately into it? Or what was the process? Just walk me through it. You went to see Martin before. But
initially, I saw them before you started.
Yeah,
and they kind of outlined the sort of stuff they were interested in. And then I hadn't, you know, this hadn't even occurred to me at that point. And then when I was kind of halfway through the process of making it, maybe a little bit before that, I kind of said, I've got this project. It might kind of fit what you guys do. And they did have their reservations that it was a bit too niche, that maybe it wouldn't quite, you know, they have a very set business model that they want it to be a very democratic photo book. So, you know, hence the price point and the size. And so they have to sell a certain amount. And it is, you know, I agree, it's slightly more niche than some of their other books. But But they were interested enough to kind of take a punt on it.
Yeah. What kind of input did Martin have? I mean, was there any suggestions that came from him that you might not have even considered in terms of sort of editing or sequencing or any of those things?
Yeah, a lot of stuff. That was a really lovely part of the process, because so often we're alone and kind of in the dark, because after a while you don't know what's good anymore. It's just a thing you're doing. And so he kind of, you know, having the book and a deadline for the book was brilliant, because it meant I was like, right, this has to be good, so I need to fill in these gaps. And, you know, he'd also tell me what some of those gaps were. And all the way down to the title, because what they do, they're reaching a wider audience than just, you know, photographers. So I had a more poetic title for it, which was One Wheel Bad. But they want their book to sort of on the shelf, someone be able, like you said, it's exactly what it says on the tin. Yeah. It's Urban Dirt Bikers. So the title changed, the cover image they helped with, and the ordering, we kind of, the designer, I gave her kind of how I like to edit my photos and how I like them to sit together as a kind of wider brief. And then she went away and came up with the order, and we tweaked it several times, but you know, she was pretty much bang on. It was kind of one of those people, rare occasions where you meet someone and they're just completely on the same page as you. So yeah, they had a really big influence on how it looks. It's yeah, really, really nice process.
Well, that's nice to hear, because so many people have various stages of nightmare when it comes to producing a book, and obviously there's lots of scope for that. So yeah, yeah. If you have a positive experience, that can only be
yeah. And I think it's, I was really lucky, because if I'd have tried to do that as a book myself, there's so many, I've never done it before, so there's so many things that I'd be sort of working out, and it would have taken so much longer. Whereas, you know, Martin's, you know, primarily a photographer and then a publisher, so he understands it from both sides. So I kind of had this person do it all that difficult stuff that I'd have had to have learned. They did all that for me. And
That's perfect. So you had this very kind of rural childhood. Did you don't have any siblings?
I do, yes. Oh, do. An older sister.
So you were, okay. But like, I guess you didn't know, she wasn't the sort of person you'd want to hang out with. I mean, you've referred to this quite isolated experience of, you know, spending a lot of time on your own. And
yeah, no, I mean, my sister actually was someone I hung out with. And the thing was, she was 2 years older than me. And then we had neighbours that we were very close to. And we had a gate joining our two gardens, so we just could walk between our houses. And they were two girls, both 2 years older than her. So they all hung out together, and I was kind of like this annoying little brother.
Right.
And she also was a lot, quite beyond her years, she was quite a mature girl. So she'd be kind of going out a lot with her friends and left home at quite a young age and stuff. So yeah, I was kind of pure, you know, we did hang out together quite a lot, but you know, playing on my own was something that I did just equally just
yeah. So sure. It sounds almost, you know, you're kind of tailor-made for someone who needed to discover the joys of a camera and what you can do just with your, you know, just yourself and your imagination. How did that happen then?
So my mum was a very keen amateur photographer. So she's kind of, my dad's kind of from a more engineering background, and he made screws and bolts for a living. So my mum was kind of the artistic one, and my dad was kind of the technical one. So it was kind of a nice combination. So, but yeah, she was kind of doing kind of classes and amateur photography, and I kind of got hand-me-down cameras from her, and I think they kind of recognized that I was sort of genuinely interested in it and fostered that, which I was really lucky to have that.
Right, so you had good parenting, you had quite an idyllic, sounds quite idyllic, it's all looking quite positive so far. But then, so yeah, did you went to college and studied it, didn't you?
Yes, so I got to the end of my GCSEs, went into A-levels, and just, I think I'd burnt out by that stage, and I just didn't really see what I was there to do. The only thing I enjoyed at the time was design technology, which I was doing one of my A-levels in. So I ended up going to college in Kent to study design, and it was kind of a broader BTEC, so I studied graphic design, product design and I forget what the third one was, but basically I was doing product design, and then the graphic design kind of did a Friday course in photography. He was quite into photography, the tutor there. And I started doing that, and the product design for me, I wasn't really enjoying it anymore. He kind of fostered the photography side of me, and so I switched over to graphic design for my final year, with an emphasis on photography. And then after that, went to Falmouth University and studied photography as a degree. So all in all, I'd studied for 5 years.
Right. Was that quite a positive experience for you to do a degree? Because it occurred to me, back in the day, they used to, you know, pay you to do a degree. And, yeah, you know, there was no question of it costing anything. I mean, obviously, you might end up a little bit skint if you really kind of, you know, spent too much money on beer. But now it's a totally, totally different proposition. I'm just thinking about whether it's something that, you know, younger people have to consider, whether it's worthwhile. But you know, what was your degree experience like?
Well, I kind of fell into the I was somewhere in between where fee paying got introduced, but it was like £2,000 a year, something right. You know, it wasn't much. I don't know how people do it these days. It's I think it's really exclusive, and it's really sad, because for me it was, you know, you had to be able to afford to live and eat. So it wasn't, certainly I wasn't coming out with the kind of debts they come out with now. So yeah, it was wholly positive. And you know, I Falmouth is an idyllic place as well. It's by the sea. To be honest, I spent the you know, best part of my first 2 years there partying, and it wasn't until the third year that I luckily knuckled down.
Right, fairly standard kind of arrangement, yeah. Then so you came out, I guess, with the sort of intent of what, becoming a jobbing editorial photographer. I mean, you're known really, I guess, mainly as a portrait guy.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I'd say, yeah.
Whether you like it or not, but that's where a lot. I mean, obviously, that's where, you know, that is what editorial photography for the most part is. So if you've got that string to your bow, then it can only be a good thing in terms of earning a living. Who did you sort of start out working for? What was your big break?
So I actually didn't know that that's where I was headed. I've always been kind of. Always the aim for me was to be a fine art photographer and produce books and exhibitions, but I wanted to do photography as a living, and I don't have a trust fund. I don't have kind of ways and means of producing work other than being a jobbing photographer. So that was kind of how I ended up in it. And the kind of traditional route is you go and assist for X amount of years. So I assisted for three or four years for various people. I never had kind of a full-time assisting job. And then I think the big break kind of came, I'd won a thing called the AOP bursary, which didn't run for very long. In fact, I think it was the last year it ran was the year I sort of won it. And I'd done this project all about kind of, it was called Wastelands, and it was all about where rubbish goes to live and how it's hidden from our eyes. And I kind of tried to make these beautiful landscapes out of waste to engage people with kind of that, you know, environmental themes. And I sent it to a picture editor at the Telegraph called Nikki Catley. And she said, look, we don't really run this sort of thing. We're kind of quite a celebrity driven magazine, but how would you like to do some portraits for us? And at that time I'd done a little bit for a magazine called Adrenaline Magazine, which is pretty much what became Huck Magazine. A lot of the people from there started Huck Magazine. So I'd done a few kind of portraits of surfers and things like that for them, but really nothing to speak of.
So she hadn't even seen any portrait work from you, really?
There were the portraits of my family that I said about earlier, and the sort of surfer portraits and a couple of other things that I'd done as personal work. But it was mainly kind of, you know, what I do now, these kind of landscape still life portraits sort of intermingled. And she just saw something, you know, which I was really lucky at. You know, there were a lot of good picture editors around at the time, and I was really lucky that she kind of took that punt on me. And within doing one job for her, I was shooting a cover for her And then after shooting that cover, I was shooting covers every month for them.
Wow.
And that changed my portfolio. I mean, I'd suddenly had this celebrity portfolio. And through necessity, I'd kind of adopted this style of, because I was so often getting sent to like these soulless hotel rooms of, and it's, you know, I'm not inventing the wheel. I just, you know, because I was in those positions, I was doing like pop-up studios in rooms. And so they knew that I was a safe pair of hands. They, you know, they knew they could kind of send me in with a very sort of short time span and come back with a decent cover image. And that then, having that in my portfolio, then was enough to tell other people that I was able to do that. And so then I quickly started, you know, I was shooting for The Guardian and other sort of mainly Sunday supplements to start with.
Yeah, and I can kind of see why that, you know, that style, like you say, is, you know, when you look at those, you think, okay, that would go on, that would be a good cover shot. You know, what you're saying basically is that you shoot against the plain background and, you know, everything looks kind of like a studio shot, even, you know, and like you say, there's a, you know, the obvious way of dealing with the fact that you never know what kind of environment you're going to find yourself in. Quite often in some crappy hotel room or something, which, you know, is not particularly conducive. So it was, so that was a deliberate...
Or you were there the week before, and so you'd basically got everything you were going to get out of it the week before, because everyone did their press junkets in the same hotel.
Yeah. So you get around that by just throwing a background up.
Yeah.
And a lot of your portraits, people are looking away from the camera. Is that a deliberate thing? Or is that just...
Yeah, I find it more engaging. I feel like there's more of an open narrative. It's kind of less obvious. You know, I have done them because they are kind of a requirement of a lot of newspapers, but the kind of inane grin into the camera doesn't really interest me. I think you can kind of, it kind of allows you access to someone that you wouldn't have if their eyes are engaging you, because you don't feel they're looking back at you, so you can investigate a bit more. And I think, although I say it's through necessity, I've always kind of loved photographers like Avedon, that stripping everything back so that everything's graphic and more poignant and, you know, more engaging, I think.
Actually, it's funny, I just got the email today about the Taylor Wessing Portrait Prize, which has just been announced. And you've had quite a lot of success in that particular prize. You won it a few years ago.
That's right, yeah.
And you've made it through to the... I think for the most part, people, you know, just want to get into the exhibition. That's the kind of... the aim for most people. But what, you know, what advice have you got for people who, you know, want to enter that competition?
Well, you know what, it's, for me, that was always the one. Like, it probably seemed for a while like I entered a lot of competitions, but there were only a few that I really kind of aspired to being in, and I think it was because they suited my aesthetic, they suited my kind of choices with photography, so they'd be the ones I'd enter. But I suppose advice for people who want to enter and get into the exhibition is really, you just got to don't try and shoot specifically for the Taylor Wessing Portrait Prize, because I think that's a trap, and I don't think you'd get in. Maybe you would, maybe I'm wrong, but I think you have to shoot what you want to shoot, and then if you think this is a good portrait to enter into the Taylor Wessing Prize, then that's the best route in. And don't enter stuff half-heartedly. Don't enter stuff that you think you need to enter six pictures, because there's a six picture limit and you're just making up the numbers. Enter stuff that you want to be in, because if it gets in and it wasn't the one, that you'd be devastated.
No, exactly. Yeah. You want to just, it's better to fail with the picture that you really like than to get in with one that you kind of don't really weigh. In a way, I think maybe some people would disagree, but if you're trying to choose between, you know, one and another, how do you do that? Is it very instinctive?
Yeah, it has to be. It has to be like this guttural response that, I don't think you choose it for judges or for competitions. I think that's just a mistake. I think it has to be your choice, and it has to be for the right reasons. And that's I mean, that's the same with editing a book, that's the same with editing a portfolio. You know portfolio, maybe not so much, maybe you have to put in the odd one that's going to get you this job, but with everything else, with exhibitions and books and competitions, it has to be your choice at the end of the day. I think
the picture you won for was a jockey, a woman jockey, which came from a a commercial commission. Was for Channel 4 TV.
Yeah.
So, you know, that in a way is kind of a win-win because, I guess it goes to show that you can get something that's sort of, you know, aesthetically and artistically stands on its own, even from, you know, a commission that was for a client rather than something that you've generated yourself. But how did that, like, happen? Did they have the whole idea already for you, or did you kind of suggest what was going to happen once, you know, you were brought in to sort of talk about the commission?
So it's a combination of both, really. It was, I was working with a really great art director, art buyer called Alice Tonge. And it was, I mean, it was, the idea was her idea. She wanted to celebrate the jockeys as these kind of unsung kind of extreme sportsmen. And because generally they're seen on top of the horse with goggles and helmet on, so you don't really see their faces. So what was nice was we went and recced the location. We agreed on kind of background colors and how they would look, and that I would, you know, that I wanted to shoot on 5x4 film. So it was a really collaborative, beyond the kind of the initial idea and the research about how, you know, how they got muddied and scarred and all this stuff that she'd done, which, you know, I can't say enough how massively that sort of led to the picture.
Right.
But it was a really collaborative experience, and in my experience that has been always a positive thing. It's always led to the better photographs, is when they kind of give you a little bit of free rein beyond the idea. So yeah, it was a kind of a combination of the two. And we did shoot it digitally, because I just don't feel you can't leave that out with advertising photography. There's too much riding on it. So we'd shoot digitally, see the image on screen, get it to a place we liked, and then I'd shoot maybe a roll of film and four sheets of 5x4 at the end. But the edit that we came up with at the end was all film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's quite telling in a way, yeah, I suppose. Yeah. But they were literally just off the horse at the end of a race.
Some of them were, some of them weren't.
Or was it some? Or was it mocked up?
It was recreations.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and she was one of those because she didn't race there. AP McCoy, for instance, who's sort of the most famous one we photographed, has this scar on his face from being double kicked in the face by a horse, which Alice again had researched it, and we'd actually got prosthetics in to recreate it. So they're all actual things that had happened from actual pictures, but we recreated pictures, and to the point that the changing room there was very limiting. It wasn't nice looking. So we actually commandeered a cafe next door to the changing rooms that wasn't being used, and we built our own changing rooms, which was a bit more aesthetically pleasing,
right.
To the point where we picked the paint colours and dressed the mud on the walls and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So I don't really talk openly about it, because I think the ambiguity is what kind of, like, if people know it's staged, then it kind of delivers a different message. So I tried to leave it a little bit ambiguous when it won the award, just because I think it kind of, people are like, oh, it's fake.
Yeah.
It's the kind of, because it's staged, it's fake, it's right, kind of right. Reaction. But
the expression on her face was certainly, you know, was what it was. And it was something, there was something quite special about just that particular moment, like that look that you captured, I think, you know, that sort of combination of strength and vulnerability all in one picture.
Yeah. And there was a set of circumstances that led to it as well, because we asked her to have her hair down. And she didn't want to have her hair down, and she was actually quite annoyed. There's a little kind of bit of wet hair kind of on her forehead that's not completely slicked back, and she was actually quite annoyed about it when she saw the picture. But her reaction from us having that process of saying, "Will you wear your hair down?" and her like having to really strongly say, "No, that's not what I do," then it sort of intensified that expression. So we were like, everyone recognized that was a good thing to have happened, and it kind of brought up something quite strong within her.
Yeah.
So everyone fell silent, me and the art director, and we were like, and just kind of got her in front of the camera and got the process started as quickly as possible after that conversation.
All right. So what do you think makes a good portrait?
Really tough question, I think.
Yeah, maybe it's a crap question. I mean, I don't even know if it can be answered.
For me, it's not what makes a good portrait, but what makes a portrait kind of good for me is something that engages you for a long time and makes you question what's going on in the person's head. Just something a bit mystifying about it. It doesn't have all the answers right there for you. And you know, one of my favorite portraits is Avedon's portrait of Ezra Pound.
Oh, right. I don't think I've seen that one.
So he's kind of, there's two portraits, and it's often shown in diptych. One's very close up, and it's, you know, he's looking very somber. And the other, he's got kind of his shirt open, and he looks like he's singing, and his eyes are closed and stuff. And it's just, there's real kind of raw emotion going on in it. And it's just, you kind of want to know what's happening. And that for me is something that, even when you strip back to like a Head and Shoulders studio portrait like this, it's not an instant tells you a story. It's something that engages you more than that.
Yeah, that slight sense of, like you say, ambiguity or mystery or whatever. How do you sort of interact with your subjects? Are you quite sort of, you're very unassuming, so I presume that is the same persona you have when you've got, you know, a famous person in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't put on an act. I'm quite the opposite. I'm not one of these people that it's a big song and a dance to get a reaction. Through necessity as well as, you know, the result I want to achieve, I'm often given, you know, 20 minutes with someone. So your time is really precious, and every minute that you're talking to them is a minute of photography that you're losing. So what I generally do is we'll have a brief conversation at the beginning, depending on how much time we've got, and I'll try and get to know them and let them get to know me. And then I'll kind of try and put into their mind some ideas of what I'm trying to achieve. And then once they're in front of the camera, I'll say as little as possible. And I'll motion with my hand to move their head or their eyes. They'll just follow my hand. Unless I feel I have to say something. And if I have to say something, I probably won't say it from camera. I'll probably go into set and have a talk with them and again put more ideas in their head. So the actual photography process is a very quiet process.
Quite sort of meditative almost.
Yeah. And some people don't like that. I've had experiences that have gone really wrong because of that. Like I photographed the Beastie Boys once, and they really weren't into it because they're so full of energy, and they were constantly shrugging and looking at their sort of management, like, what's going on here?
Right, because you weren't really talking to them.
He's not telling me to do anything, so what do I do? But
right,
I find actors are just a joy because they just get that. That's how they work. Yeah. You know, once they're in front of the camera, they're not being so much directed.
They
so
don't
much
need to be directed, no.
Yeah.
Just
so
do it.
So they'll give me so much, and you know, sort of like the portrait of Mark Rylance. That was one of I had 20 that I struggled to pick from.
Really?
Whereas usually with most people, it's just like that's the one. You have this one image, and that's the one. With him, it was such a hard edit because he just gave me so much.
Right. Yeah, and I kind of like the one that's more of sort of environmental. I think he's sitting on the bench.
Yeah,
I think is it at the Globe Theatre or something?
Right, yeah.
But then I guess that's just me. I mean, the other shot, which has got more of your trademark kind of plain background, I guess it was a cover.
It was for Telegraph.
But
magazine.
that one also I think did well in the Taylor West thing, or one of the
that
prizes.
That was my first. Acceptance into the final four the year previous, and I got third place that year.
Wow.
And really entering it the following year, I thought that was the pinnacle for me.
Yeah.
I was quite happy, and it was, like you say, just about getting in the exhibition has always been something that I wanted. I'd been to see it when I was at university, and that was kind of, from then on, I'd followed it and I wanted to be in it. So I had no expectations of winning the following year, quite the opposite.
Yeah, of course. That must have been a bit of a pleasant surprise. So who were the guys that you were inspired by? Was it Alex Soth you mentioned? I think Joel Sternfeld you've mentioned in the past.
Yes. I mean, Alex Soth, I'd graduated from university and I was already kind of doing something a bit similar. But finding Sleeping by the Mississippi in the bookshop was, for me, like affirmation of like, you can actually do this. It doesn't have to be pure documentary-led photography. You can do something a bit more poetic and sort of something that doesn't really have a thread running for it. Like for him, it was the Mississippi, and there wasn't much more like linking this photo to the next photo, and the ordering of photos, the rhythm he had, like that for me was a really big turning point. But while I was still at university, going into my final year, I discovered Joel Sternfeld, and that again, that was probably the biggest turning point in my work, because to my knowledge, I'd not been shown that at university, but I wasn't turning up for a lot at that point. And I'd got my grandma had left me some inheritance, and with it, I bought my first medium format camera, and I went to America and landed September the 10th, 2001. So then the next day, I woke up in LA, turned the TV on. No, the TV was on because I'd fallen asleep to the TV, and I thought it was a film. Went down for breakfast, because I was on my own, no one told me what was going on. Went back up to my room, and the same film was still on. I was like, hang on, what's going on? And I was meant to be on a United Airlines flight that morning, but obviously the airport was closed by then. So I'd sort of bussed and trained up to San Francisco. And it just so happened, so it's a very somber time to be there. I went weeks without speaking to anyone, and it just so happened that SF MoMA were showing Joel Sternfeld, Stranger Passing. And I don't even think I just happened upon the gallery. Although it seems in my mind that's the history I've made up, is that I just wandered into this gallery and discovered this work. And it kind of emboldened me then, because I was then, you know, how we talked about kind of how sort of my social angst, and it emboldened me to I'll go up and approach strangers and take photos. So then going from 2 weeks of not speaking to anyone, I was approaching strangers and making portraits pretty much in Joel Sternfeld style or what I could muster.
So that was a direct result of being influenced and inspired by that particular book or that particular photographer in this case.
Yeah.
You know, sort of changed everything about the way that you approached it. Yeah, it's not easy going up to strangers if you have a tendency to be kind of shy and socially awkward.
And if they say no, it's devastating. Yeah. Don't ask another person for like hours, because it's just, and you know, even to the, you know, even now when I did the bikers, it was the same. If someone said no, it would put such a sort of bitter taste in your mouth that the next person you'd be even more angsty about approaching.
Yeah. But the lesson is to just do, you know, to find a way to you know, transcend your natural tendencies and just, you know, do it anyway, somehow or other. I think that's just think about it.
I can't remember, there's a photographer that says about it, just about there's a time limit to, you can't just sort of like loiter around people. I think it's like 3 seconds or something. You have to just go and ask, and you have to just
I think it's Martin Parr. Well, that came up quite recently when I talked to Annie Collins, but yeah, Martin Parr said don't linger.
Right. Linger. That's probably where I've got it from, is also listening to your podcast.
Yeah, probably that's where it's come from. Because I was talking about the 3 second rule when it comes to, you know, trying to chat someone up in a pub, you know, like don't, if you wait longer than 3 seconds, you're going to lose your bottle.
Yeah.
So,
which I don't think I've ever chatted someone up in my life.
There you go. Similar principle. Same with taking pictures of a stranger. So I guess I was going to say, what are your strengths and weaknesses? And do you sort of try and work on your weaknesses, whatever you perceive them to be? I guess that would count, really, in a kind of slight discomfort with the process.
Yeah, I think that probably, yeah. Getting myself out there and doing it, you know, can be hard sometimes. You know, the limitations of... I've always been kind of lived hand to mouth ever since I moved to London, and I think it's been a harder and harder environment to work in. It's sort of part of a generation that came when people started using image libraries more, and then eventually digital came in and there were more photographers, so it's hard to make money doing what we're doing. So I've always kind of put my money back into my practice. So sometimes that has been a real limitation, is just not getting myself out, partly because of of how I feel, you know, approaching people. And partly because of time restrictions or money restrictions. So I'd say that's probably my biggest flaw. I'd say kind of my strength is probably sort of that I'm at heart a technician, that I, you know, I still shoot on film cameras and I understand the way it works. I use a light meter and I have kind of a graphic way of seeing things. So, and especially when I'm shooting 5x4, because it's upside down and back to front, everything becomes graphic shapes anyway. So.
Right. But if you're shooting a commission for, you know, the Guardian Weekend magazine or someone like that, are you still shooting film now?
Well, I shoot very rarely now. I'm less than I'd like to be. I don't shoot so much of that stuff anymore.
Do you think you'd go digital if you had to do that more frequently?
Do you know what? I'd maybe shoot a bit digital. I'd like use that as a Polaroid camera in a way, and as a safety net. But I can't remember the last thing I shot, but everything editorially, I don't think I've ever really shot that much digital. And I, like, a year or so ago, I shot Michael Caine and we did that 5.4 and used old 5.4 Polaroid and all sorts. And
what was it like shooting Michael Caine? Got to ask that question.
It was good. Yeah, I mean, it's just his voice is so it's kind of hypnotic. Yeah, and iconic. You kind of walk into the room and it's like, I don't really get starstruck anymore because you're so like concentrated on what you're doing. But the voice was definitely like kind of unsettled me.
This is Michael Caine.
Yeah.
That wasn't an impression of him. That would have been a terrible impression of him. That was an impression of you thinking in your head, oh my God, it's Michael Caine. So are you not good at hustling for work then? I mean, do you do that? Do you, like, you know, phone picture desks and say, look, you know, can I have a job, please? Because, you know, I think there's a kind of spectrum of how good we are at that among
Not enough anymore. I mean, when I first came to London, I was a bit more confident, I think. And I knew it was something I had to do. So I would generally do the process of sending people an email and then sending them a postcard and calling them up and do it as, you know, a system. But since I've had an agent and they're doing the hustling for me on the advertising side, I kind of fell out of it a little bit and I don't go around with my portfolio.
But you've got something else to replace it in a way. I mean,
I survived through advertising work and print sales to some degree and then resales of my old celebrity stuff. So I've got kind of different kind of, the other stuff is kind of trickles of money, whereas the advertising is like a kind of big chunk of money. And that kind of, I mean, that's what made me able to shoot the Urban Dirt Bikers stuff and spend a year on it. Not that it was an expensive project, because it was just me and the film, really. That was the only cost was travel and film. But that's, you know, doing the advertising is what enabled me to shoot my personal work.
Well, I mean, even the film, you know, the film these days is you know, that can get expensive if it's a big project like that. Shot a lot of it. I mean, obviously people shooting digital don't even have to consider that, but it's more of it's time, you know, because time is money, as they say, and that is true. So yeah, like you say, to kind of bring it full circle, you are now in that kind of almost like a nice place to be, where you're thinking about the next thing, but you've got something tangible, and it's your first book. You haven't done one before now.
No, I made a little booklet in my kind of, like, maybe just after university of that relative project I told you about. So I sort of self-published a little kind of booklet as self-promotion, really. But as a published book that's sold somewhere, that is my first book. Quite happy with it.
Yeah, you should be. It's lovely. Good luck with it, Spencer. It's called Urban Dirt Bikers. It's published by Hoxton Mini Press. If any of you listeners want to have a look, hoxtonminipress.com. And Spencer's website is spencermurphy.co.uk. Spencer, thanks a lot, man. It was great meeting you.
You too.
Really nice to chat. And I look forward to going to the launch thing, which is in a few nights' time. But this podcast will go out sometime after that.
Great.
So
thank you.
If you're listening to this, you've already missed it. Thanks, Spencer.
Cheers. Thanks.